But something did not ring true to me. I said, I don't know. Even supposing this experience of Mrs. Eyre's is to be purely delusional, and assuming that, incident by incident, we can find a perfectly rational explanation for everything else that's happened out at the Hall, which, by the way, I think we can, still, it's the cumulative nature of it all that troubles me. He took another sip of his whiskey. What do you mean? Well, put it like this. A child comes to you with a broken arm. All right, you set the bone and send him home. 2 weeks later he returns, with broken ribs this time. Perhaps you patch him up and send him home again. A week later he's back with another fracture. The individual broken bones are no longer the main problem, surely. But we're not talking about bones, said Seeley. We're talking about hysteria, and hysteria's altogether stranger. And, unfortunately, unlike broken bones, contagious. I was a medical officer to a girls' school years ago, and one term there was a fashion for fainting. You never saw anything like it. Girls going down in assembly like skittles. In the end, even the mistresses were doing it. I shook my head. This is a weirder thing even than hysteria. It's as if... well, as if something's slowly sucking the life out of the whole family. Something is, he said with another bark of laughter. It's called a Labour government. The Eyres' problem, don't you think, is that they can't or won't adapt. Don't get me wrong, I've a lot of sympathy for them, but what's left for an old family like that in England nowadays? Class-wise, they've had their chips. Nerve-wise, perhaps, they've run their course. He sounded like Peter Baker Hyde now, but I found his briskness rather repellent. After all, I thought, he had never become a friend to the family as I had. I said, that might be true enough of Rod. Anyone who knew that boy well could have predicted that he was heading for some sort of breakdown. But Mrs. Eyre's? A suicide? I don't believe it. Oh, I'm not suggesting for a moment that in putting her hands through that window she was really meaning to end her life. I should say that, like most supposedly suicidal women, she was simply creating a nice little drama with herself at its heart. She's used to attention, don't forget, and I can't imagine she's been getting too much of it lately. You'll want to be careful she doesn't try the same sort of trick again once all the current fuss has died down. You're keeping an eye on her? Of course I am. She seems to be making a full recovery. That baffles me, too. I took a gulp of whiskey. The whole bloody business baffles me. There are things that have happened over at Hundreds that I can't explain. It's as if the house is in the grip of some sort of miasma. Caroline, I spoke reluctantly, Caroline's even had the idea in her head that there's been something almost supernatural going on, that Roderick's been haunting the house or something in his sleep. She's been reading some lurid books, crank stuff, Frederick Myers, people like that. Well, said Seeley, stubbing out his cigarette, perhaps she's on to something. I stared at him. You're not serious. Why not? Myers's ideas are the natural extension of psychology, surely. I said, not as I understand psychology, no. Are you sure? You subscribe, I suppose, to the general principle, a conscious personality and a subliminal self, a sort of dream self attached? Broadly, yes. Well, then suppose that dream self could, in certain circumstances, break loose, detach itself, cross space, become visible to others. Isn't that Myers's thesis? I said, as far as I know, and it makes for a good fireside story, but for God's sake, there isn't an ounce of science in it. Not yet there isn't, he said, smiling. And I wouldn't like to air the theory in front of the county medical board, certainly, but perhaps in 50 years' time medicine will have found a way to calibrate the phenomenon and will have explained it all. Meanwhile, people will go on talking about ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties, simply missing the point. He sipped at his whiskey, then went on in a different tone. My father saw a ghost once, you know. My grandmother appeared one night at his surgery door. She'd been dead 10 years. She said, "Quickly, Jamie, go home." He didn't stop to think it over. He put on his coat and went straight to the family house. He found that his favourite brother, Henry, had injured his hand, and the wound was rapidly turning septic. He cut off a finger and probably saved his brother's life. Now, how do you explain that? I said, I can't. But I'll tell you something. My father used to hang a bull's heart in the chimney stuck with pins. He had it there to keep evil spirits away. I know how I'd explain that. Seeley laughed. Not a fair comparison. Why not? because your father was a gentleman and mine a shopkeeper? Don't be so touchy, man. Listen to me now. I don't think for a moment that my father truly saw a ghost that night, any more than I think poor Mrs. Ayres has been receiving calls from her dead daughter. The idea of one's deceased relations floating around in the ether, keeping their gimlet eyes on one's affairs, is really too much to stomach. But suppose the stress of my uncle's injury, combined with the bond between him and my father, suppose all of that somehow released some sort of psychic force. The force simply took the shape that would best get my father's attention. Very bright of it, too. But what's been happening at Hundreds, I said. There's nothing benign about that. Quite the reverse. Is that so surprising, with things for that family so bleak? The subliminal mind has many dark, unhappy corners, after all. Imagine something loosening itself from one of those corners. Let's call it a germ. And let's say conditions prove right for that germ to develop, to grow like a child in the womb. What would this little stranger grow into? A sort of shadow self, perhaps. A Caliban. A Mr. Hyde. A creature motivated by all the nasty impulses and hungers the conscious mind had hoped to keep hidden away. Things like envy and malice and frustration. Caroline suspects her brother. Well, as I said before, she might be right. Maybe it wasn't only bones that got fractured in that crash of his. Maybe it was something even deeper. Then again, it's generally women, you know, at the root of this sort of thing. There's Mrs. Ayres, of course, the menopausal mother. That's a queer time, psychically. And don't they even have some teenage housemaid out there, too? I looked away from him. They do. She's the one who got them all thinking about spooks in the first place. Is that right? And how old is she? 14? 15? Doesn't get much chance to flirt with the boys, I imagine, stuck out there. I said, Oh, she's a child still. Well, the sexual impulse is the darkest of all and has to emerge somewhere. It's like an electrical current. It has a tendency, you know, to find its own conductors. But if it goes untapped, well, then it's a rather dangerous energy. I was struck by the word. I said slowly, Caroline spoke of energies. Caroline's a clever girl. I always thought she got the thick end of things in that family. Kept at home with a second-rate governess while the boy was packed off to public school, and then just when she'd got out to be dragged back again by her mother so that she could wheel Roderick up and down the terrace in his bath chair. Next, I suppose, she'll be wheeling Mrs. Ayres. What she needs, of course. He smiled again, and the smile was sly. Well, it's hardly my place. But the girl isn't getting any younger, and, my dear fellow, neither are you. You've put this whole case before me and haven't mentioned your own situation once. What exactly is it? You and she have some sort of understanding, is that it? Nothing firmer than that? I felt the whiskey inside me. Raising my glass for another gulp, I said quietly, The firmness is all on my side. Rather too much of it, to be honest with you. He looked surprised. Like that? I nodded. Well, well. I'd never have guessed it. Of Caroline, I mean. Though there, perhaps, you have the root of your miasma. His expression was slyer than ever now, and I took a second to understand him. I said at last, You aren't suggesting— He held my gaze, then started to laugh. He was enjoying himself enormously, I realized suddenly. He polished off the rest of his whiskey, then generously refilled our glasses and lit a second cigarette. He began to tell me another ghost story, this one more fantastic than the last. But I barely heard it. He'd started me thinking, and the beat of my thoughts, like the ticking arm of a metronome, would not be stilled. It was all nonsense. I knew it was nonsense. Every ordinary thing around me worked against it. The fire was crackling in the grate. The children still thundered on the staircase. The whiskey was fragrant in the glass. But the night was dark at the window, too, and a few miles away through the wintry darkness stood Hundreds Hall, where things were different. Could what he had suggested have any truth to it? Could there be something loose in that house? Some sort of ravenous, frustrated energy with Caroline at its heart? I thought back to the start of it all, to the night of that unlucky party when Caroline had been so humiliated and the Baker Hyde child had ended up hurt. What if some process had begun that night, some queer seed being sown? I remembered, in the weeks that followed, Caroline's mounting hostility towards her brother, her impatience with her mother. Both her brother and her mother had become injured, just like Gillian Baker Hyde, and it was Caroline who had first brought these injuries to my attention, Caroline who had noticed the burns in Roderick's room, who had discovered the fire, who had heard the taps and felt the little rapping hand behind the wall. Then I thought of something else. The thing that had started with Jip, perhaps as a nip, or a whisper, as Betty, I suddenly realized, had put it, that thing had been slowly gathering strength. It had moved things about, lit fires, put scribbles on a wainscot. Now it could run on pattering feet. It could be heard as a struggling voice. It was growing. It was developing. What would it be next? Unnerved, I moved forward. Seeley offered the bottle again, but I shook my head. "I've wasted enough of your time. I really must go. It's been good of you to listen," he said. "I'm not sure I've done much to reassure you. You look worse than you did when you arrived. Why not stay longer?" But he was interrupted by the noisy re-entrance of his good-looking son. Loosened up by the whiskey, he leapt from his chair and chased the child back out into the hall, and by the time he had returned to me, I had finished my drink and had my hat and coat on ready to leave. He had a better head for alcohol than I did. He saw me breezily to the door, but I made my way out into the night, not quite steady on my feet, and feeling the liquor hot and sour in my unlined stomach. I drove the short distance home, then stood in my cold dispensary, the nausea rising like a wave inside me, and rising with it something worse than nausea, almost a dread. My heart was beating unpleasantly hard. I took off my coat and found I was sweating. After a moment of indecision, I went through to my consulting room. I picked up the telephone and, with clumsy fingers, dialed the hundreds number. It was after 11. The phone rang and rang. Then came Caroline's cautious voice.
"Yes? Hello?"
"Caroline, it's me."
Her tone at once grew anxious. "Is something the matter? We'd gone to bed. I thought—"
I said, "Nothing's the matter. Nothing. I just wanted to hear your voice." I spoke simply, I suppose. There was a silence, and then she laughed. The laughter was tired, ordinary. The dread and the nausea began to dwindle, as if punctured by a pin. She said,
"I think you must be a little drunk."
I wiped my face. "I think I am. I've been with Seeley, and he's been plying me with whiskey. God, what a brute that man is. He's had me thinking ridiculous things. It's so good to hear you, Caroline. Say something else."
She tutted. "How silly you are. What on earth will the operator think? What should I say?"
"Say anything. Say a poem."
"A poem. All right."
And she went on, in a prompt, perfunctory way,
"The frost performs its secret ministry unhelped by any wind. Now go to bed, will you?"
"I will, in a second. I just want to think of you there. Everything's all right, isn't it?" She sighed.
"Yes, everything's all right. The house is behaving itself for once. Mother's asleep, unless you've woken her."
I said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Caroline. Good night."
"Good night," she said, laughing tiredly again.
She put up the receiver, and I heard the laughter fade. Then came the click of the broken connection, followed by the vague hiss and muddle of other people's voices trapped in the wire.
Chapter 12. The next time I called in at Hundreds, I found Barrett there. Caroline had brought him in to rip out that troublesome speaking tube. I saw the tube as he took it away, and, just as I'd guessed, its braiding in places was loose and torn, and the rubber beneath quite perished. It looked as harmless and pathetic, coiled in his arms, as a mummified snake. Mrs. Baseley and Betty, however, were reassured by its removal, and began to lose the air of tension and dread which had possessed them both since the day of what we all now refer to as Mrs. Ayres's accident. Mrs. Ayres herself also continued to recover well. Her cuts healed cleanly. She spent her days down in the little parlour, reading or dozing in her chair. There was just a slight trace of glassiness or remoteness to her, to hint at the ordeal she had been through, and most of that I put down to the effects of the veronal, which she was continuing to take to help her sleep at nights, and which, in the short term, I thought, could do her no harm. I rather regretted that Caroline was kept so much indoors now, sitting with her mother, for it meant that she and I had even fewer opportunities to be alone together. But I was glad to see that she, too, was less preoccupied and fretful. She seemed to have become reconciled to the loss of her brother, for instance, since our visit to the clinic, and, to my very great relief, there was no more talk of poltergeists and spooks. But then, there were no more mysterious occurrences either. No rings on the bells, no raps, no footsteps, no more curious incidents of any kind. The house continued to, as Caroline had put it, behave itself. And as March drew to a close and one uneventful day gave way to another, I really began to think that the strange spell of nervousness that had been cast over Hundreds in the past few weeks must somehow, like a fever, have reached its crisis and worn itself out. Then, at the end of the month, there came changes in the weather. The skies darkened, the temperature plummeted, and we had snow. The snow was a novelty, nothing at all like the impossible blizzards and drifts of the previous winter, but it was a nuisance to me and my fellow GPs, and even with chains on its tires my Ruby struggled with the roads. My round became something of a slog, and for more than a week the park at Hundreds was quite impassable, the drive too treacherous to be risked. Still, I managed to get out to the hall quite often, leaving the car at the east gates and going the rest of the way on foot. I went mainly to see Caroline, not liking to think of her out there, cut off from the world. I went to keep an eye on Mrs. Ayres, too, but I also liked those journeys for their own sake. Breaking free of the snowy drive, I never got my first glimpse of the house without a thrill of awe and pleasure. For against the white, white ground it looked marvellous, the red of its brick and the green of its ivy more vivid, and all its imperfections softened by a lacework of ice. There would be no hum from the generator, no snarl of machinery from the farm, no clash of building work. The building work had been suspended because of the snow. Only my own quiet footsteps would disturb the silence, and I would move on, almost abashed, trying to muffle them further, as if the place were enchanted, as if it were the castle of the Belle au Bois Dormant I remembered Caroline envisaging a few weeks before, and I feared to break the spell. Even the interior of the house was subtly transformed by the weather, the glass dome above the stairwell now translucent with snow, making the hall dimmer than ever, and the windows letting in a chill, reflected light from the whitened ground, so that shadows fell puzzlingly. The stillest of those snow-bound days was a Tuesday, the 6th of April. I went out to the house in the afternoon, expecting to find Caroline, as usual, sitting downstairs with her mother, but it was Betty, it seemed, who had been keeping Mrs. Ayres company that day. They had a table between them, and were playing draughts, with chipped wooden pieces. A good fire was crackling in the grate, and the room was warm and stuffy. Caroline had gone over to the farm, her mother told me. She was expected back within the hour. Would I stay and wait for her? I was disappointed not to see her, and it was the quiet period before my evening surgery, so I said I would. Betty went off to make our tea, and I took her place at the draught board for a couple of games. But Mrs. Ayres played absently, losing piece after piece, and when the board had been put aside to make way for the tea tray, we sat together in near silence. There seemed little to say. She had lost her taste for county gossip over the past few weeks. I brought out a few stories, and she listened politely enough, but her responses, when they came, were distracted or oddly delayed, as if she were straining her ears to catch the words of a more compelling conversation going on in a neighbouring room. At last my small fund of anecdotes was completely used up. I rose and walked to the French window and stood gazing out over the dazzling landscape. When I turned back to Mrs. Ayres, she was rubbing her arm as if cold. Catching my eye, she said, "I'm afraid I'm dull for you, Doctor. I do apologize. That's what comes of sitting so long indoors. Shall we go out into the garden? We might meet Caroline that way." I was surprised by the suggestion, but happy to leave the airless room. I fetched her outdoor things myself, making sure she was properly dressed for the cold. I put on my overcoat and hat, and we went out by the front door. We had to pause a moment, to let our eyes grow accustomed to the whiteness of the day, but then she linked her arm with mine, and we moved off, going around the house, then making our way slowly and idly across the west lawn. The snow lay smooth as foam there, almost silky to the eye, but crisp and powdery underfoot. In places it was broken by the cartoonish tracks of birds, and soon we found more substantial prints, the dog-like pads and claws of creeping foxes. We followed those for a minute or two. They led us over to the old outbuildings. There the air of general enchantment was even more pronounced, the stable clock still fixed at 8:40 in that grim Dickensian joke, the stables themselves with their fittings all in place, their doors neatly bolted, but everything thick with cobwebs and dust, so that one half expected, on peeping inside, to find a line of slumbering horses, all thick with cobwebs, too. Beside the stables was the garage, with the bonnet of the family Rolls-Royce just showing at its half-open door. Beyond that was a chaos of bushes, and the fox tracks were lost to us. But our walk had taken us almost as far as the old kitchen gardens, so, still idly, we moved on, passing through the arch in the high brick wall to the plots beyond. Caroline had given me a tour of these gardens, back in the summer. They were barely in use now that life at the house was so diminished, and I thought them the loneliest and most melancholy section of the park. One or two beds were still relatively well tended by Barrett, but other areas which must once have been lovely had been dug over for vegetables by the soldiers during the war, and since then, without the hands to manage them, they had run wild. Brambles rose through the glassless roofs of the greenhouses. The cinder paths were choked with nettles. Here and there were great lead pots, giant saucers on slender stems, the saucers tilting tipsily where the lead had buckled from the heat of too many summers. We made our way from one untidy walled space to the next.
"Isn't it a shame?"
Mrs. Ayres said softly, now and then pausing to brush aside a frill of snow and examine the plant beneath, or simply to stand and gaze around, almost as if wanting to memorize the scene.
"The Colonel, my husband, used to love these gardens. They're arranged as a sort of spiral, each one smaller than the last, and he used to say they were like the chambers of a seashell. Such a fanciful man sometimes."
We moved on and soon passed through a narrow gateless opening into the smallest garden there, the old herb garden. At its centre was a sundial set in an ornamental pond. Mrs. Ayres said she believed the pond still had fish in it, and we wandered over to look. We found the water frozen, but the ice was thin, quite flexible, so that we could press it and watch silvery bubbles racing about underneath, like the steel balls in a child's puzzle. Then came a flash of colour, a darting of gold in the murk, and,
"There goes one," said Mrs. Ayres. She sounded pleased, but unexcited. "There's another. Do you see it? Poor things. Won't they be stifled? Isn't one supposed to break the ice? Caroline would know. I can't remember."
Retrieving a scrap of knowledge from my Boy Scouting days, I said perhaps I ought to melt it a little. I squatted at the side of the pond, breathed into my ungloved hands, and put my palms to the ice. Mrs. Ayres watched me, and then, with an elegant tucking in of her skirts, she lowered herself at my side. The ice stung. My wet hands, when I lifted them back to my mouth to warm them, felt numb and almost rubbery. I shook my fingers, pulling a face. Mrs. Ayres smiled.
"Oh, what babies you men are,"
I answered, laughing. "That's just something women say."
"Why do women say it?" "Because it's perfectly true. Women are built for pain. Now, if you men had to go through childbirth—"
She didn't finish, and her smile faded. I had my hands at my mouth again, and my falling sleeve had uncovered my wristwatch. She glanced at that and said in a different tone,
"Caroline might be at home now. You'll want to see her, of course."
I said politely, "I'm happy to stay here.
I don't want to keep you from her."
There was something to the way she said it. I met her gaze and saw that, for all Caroline and I had been so careful, she knew perfectly well how matters stood between us. Slightly self-conscious, I turned back to the pond. I put my palms to the ice again, then lifted and warmed them several times, until at last I felt the ice give way, and I saw that I had made two irregular openings into the tea-coloured water beneath. "There," I said, pleased with myself. "Now the fish can do what Eskimos do in reverse. Catch flies and what not. Shall we go on?" I offered my hand, but she didn't answer, and didn't rise. She watched me shake the water from my fingers, and then she said quietly,
"I'm glad, Dr. Faraday, about you and Caroline. I'll admit that I wasn't at first. When you began to come to the house and I saw that you and my daughter might form an attachment, I didn't like it. I'm an old-fashioned woman, and you weren't quite the match I'd planned for her. I hope you never suspected it.
I said after a moment, I think I did.
Then I'm sorry.
I gave a shrug.
Well, what does it matter now? You do mean to marry her?
Yes, I do.
You think a great deal of her?
A very great deal. I think a great deal of you all. I hope you know that. You spoke to me once of your fear of being abandoned. Well, in marrying Caroline, I mean not only to care for her, but for you and the house, for Roderick, too. You've been through some desperate times lately. But now that you're better, Mrs. Ayres, now that you're calmer, more yourself. She looked at me, saying nothing. I decided to risk it and pressed on. That time in the nursery, I said. Well, that was a strange thing, wasn't it? A horrible thing. I'm so glad it's all over. She smiled. An odd smile, patient and secret. Her high cheeks rose, narrowing her eyes. She straightened up, carefully brushing the snow from her wash-leather gloves.
Oh, Dr. Faraday, she said as she did it, what a perfect innocent you are.
She said it so mildly and with such a touch of indulgence I almost laughed. But her expression was still an odd one, and I began, without quite knowing why, to be frightened. I rose, hastily and not very gracefully, catching the tail of my overcoat underneath my heels and tipping myself off balance. She had begun to walk away. I caught up with her and touched her arm. Wait, I said. What do you mean? Her face was turned from mine, and she didn't answer. I said, there haven't been other things. You don't still imagine that Susan...
Susan,
she murmured, her face still half hidden from me.
Susan is with me all the time. She follows me wherever I go. Why, she's here in this garden with us.
For a second I managed to persuade myself that she was speaking figuratively, that all she meant was that she carried her daughter around with her in her thoughts, in her heart. But then she turned her face back to mine, and her expression had something terrible in it, a mixture of absolute loneliness, huntedness, and fear. I said, "For God's sake, why haven't you spoken of this?
And have you test me and treat me?" she said, "and tell me I'm dreaming?"
But, oh, Mrs. Ayres, my dear Mrs. Ayres, you are dreaming, don't you see? I took her two gloved hands in mine. Look around you. There's no one here. This is all in your mind. Susan died. You know that, don't you?
Of course I know it,
she said almost loftily.
How could I not? My darling died, but now she has come back.
I squeezed her fingers. But... how could she? How can you think this? Mrs. Ayres, you're a sensible woman. How does she come? Tell me, do you see her?
Oh, no. I haven't seen her yet. I feel her.
You feel her?
I feel her, watching. I feel her eyes. They must be her eyes, mustn't they? Her gaze is so strong. Her eyes are like fingers. They can touch. They can press and pinch.
Mrs. Ayres, please stop this.
I hear her voice. I don't need tubes and telephones to hear it now. She talks to me.
She talks?
She whispers.
She tilted her head as if listening, then raised her hand.
She's whispering now.
There was something horribly uncanny about the intentness of her pose. I said, not quite steadily, "What is she whispering?" Her look grew bleak again.
She says the same things every time. She says, "Where are you?" She says, "Why won't you come?" She says, "I am waiting."
She spoke these words in a whisper of her own. They seemed to hang for a moment in the air along with the cloudy breath that made them, then they vanished, eaten up by the silence. I stood frozen for a moment, not knowing what to do. A few minutes before, the little garden had appeared almost snug to me. Now the small, walled patch, with its single, narrow exit leading only to another choked and isolated space, seemed filled with menace. The day, as I have said, was a peculiarly still one,
No wind disturbed the branches of the trees, no bird rose even in the thin, chill air, and if any sound had come, any movement had been made, I would have caught it. Nothing changed. Nothing at all. And yet, it began to seem to me that something was there in the garden with us, creeping or edging towards us across the crisp, white snow. Worse than that, I had the bizarre impression that this thing, whatever it was in some way familiar, as if its bashful advance towards us was more properly a return. I felt the flesh of my back rise, anticipating a touch, as in a childish game of tig. I drew my hands from hers and twisted round, looking wildly all about. The garden was empty, the snow unmarked except by our own footprints, but my heart was lurching, my hands trembling. I took off my hat and wiped my face. My brow and lip were sweating, and where the cold air met my flushed, wet skin, it seemed to burn. I was just putting my hat back on when I heard Mrs. Eyre sharply draw in her breath. I turned back to her and found her with her gloved hand at her collar, her face creased, her colour rising. I said, "What is it? What's the matter?" She shook her head and wouldn't answer. But she looked so distressed, I thought of her heart. I plucked her hand back, drew open her scarves and coat. Beneath the coat she had on a cardigan, beneath that a silk blouse. The blouse was pale, the colour of ivory, and as I watched, incredulous. Three small drops of crimson seemed to spring from nowhere to the surface of the silk, and then, like ink on blotting paper, rapidly to spread. I tugged down the blouse's collar and saw beneath it, on her bare skin, a scratch quite deep, evidently freshly made, still rising, still beading red. "What have you done?" I said in horror. "How did you do this?" I looked over her gown for a pin or a brooch. I caught up her hands, examined her gloves. There was nothing. "What did you use?" She dropped her gaze. "My little girl," she murmured. "She's so eager for me to join her. I'm afraid she isn't always kind." When I realized what she was saying, I felt sick. I stepped back, away from her. Then, with a further surge of understanding, I caught hold of her hands again and pulled the gloves from them and roughly pushed up her sleeves. Where the broken window had cut her a few weeks before, the wounds had healed pink and healthy against the paler skin. Here and there among the scars, however, it seemed to me that I could see new scratches. And one of her arms bore a faint bruise, curiously shaped, as if the flesh had been pinched and twisted by a small, determined hand. Her gloves had fallen to the ground. Trembling, I picked them up and helped her put them back on. I caught hold of her by the elbow. "I'm taking you back to the house, Mrs. Eyre." She said, "Are you trying to take me away from her? It isn't any use, you know." I turned and shook her. "Stop it! You hear me? For God's sake, stop saying these things!" She moved loosely in my arms, and after that I found I didn't quite want to look at her face again. I felt a curious shame about it. I took her wrist and led her out of the tangled gardens, and she came quite readily. We went past the frozen stable clock, back over the lawns and into the house. I took her straight upstairs, not pausing to remove her outdoor things. Only once we were in the warmth of her own room did I take her coat and hat and snowy shoes, and I put her to sit in her chair beside the fire. But then I gazed at the things that were near her. The coals in the hearth, the pokers, the tongs, the glass tumblers, the mirrors, the ornaments. Everything seemed brutal or brittle suddenly and capable of harm. I rang the bell for Betty. The lever moved uselessly in my hand, and I remembered that Caroline had cut the wire, so I went out to the top of the staircase and called into the silence, and eventually Betty came. "Don't be frightened," I said before she could speak. "I want you to keep Mrs. Eyre's company, that's all." I set down a chair and led her to it. "I want you to sit right here and make sure she has everything she needs, while I—" The fact is, having got Mrs. Eyre this far, I didn't know what to do with her. I kept thinking of the snow on the ground outside, of the isolation of the house. If even Mrs. Baisley had been there, I think I should have felt calmer. But with only Betty to help me. I hadn't even brought my doctor's bag from the car. I had no instruments, no drugs. I stood dithering, almost panicking, while the two women watched. Then I heard footsteps on the marble floor of the hall downstairs. I went to the door and looked out, and with a rush of relief I saw Caroline. just beginning to mount the stairs. She was unwinding her scarf and drawing off her hat, her brown hair falling down untidily around her shoulders. I called out to her. Startled, she looked up, then came on more hastily.
"What's the matter?"
I said, "It's your mother. Just a moment." I hurried back into the bedroom to Mrs. Ayres's side. I took her hand and spoke as I would to a child or an invalid. "I'm just going to talk with Caroline for a minute or two, Mrs. Ayres. I shall leave the door open, and you must call me. You must call me at once if anything frightens you. You understand?" She seemed weary now and didn't answer. I looked meaningfully at Betty, then went out and caught hold of Caroline and took her around the landing to her own room. I left her door ajar, too, and stood with her just inside it. She said,
"What's happened?"
I put my finger to my lips. "Speak softly. Caroline, my dear, it's your mother. God help me, but I fear I've misjudged her case, misjudged it badly. I'd supposed her showing signs of real improvement, hadn't you? But what she's just told me... Oh, Caroline, you haven't noticed any changes in her since I was last here? She hasn't seemed especially troubled, or nervous, or afraid?" She looked bewildered. She saw me moving back to the door to gaze across the landing to her mother's room, and said,
"What is it? Can't I go to her?"
I put my hands on her shoulders. "Listen," I said. "I think she's hurt."
"Hurt? How?"
"I think she's hurting herself." And I told her, as briefly as I could, what had passed between her mother and me out in the walled garden. I said, "She thinks your sister is with her all the time, Caroline. She sounded terrified, tormented. She said your sister harms her. I saw a scratch," I gestured, "just here on her collarbone. I don't know how she did it, what she used. But then I looked at her arms and saw what might have been other cuts and bruises. Have you noticed anything? You must have seen something, haven't you?"
"Cuts and bruises," she said, struggling to take the idea in. "I'm not sure. Mother has always bruised rather easily, I think, and I know the Veronal makes her clumsy."
"This isn't clumsiness. This is... I'm sorry, my darling. Her mind has gone." She looked at me, and her face seemed to close. She turned away.
"Let me see her."
"Wait," I said, drawing her back. She shook me off, suddenly angry.
"You promised me. I told you weeks ago. I warned you that there was something in this house. You laughed at me, and you said that if I did what you told me to do, she'd be all right. Well, I've watched and watched her. I've sat with her day after day. I've made her take those hateful pills. You promised."
"I'm sorry, Caroline. I did my best. Her condition was worse than I knew. If we can just watch her a little longer, just for tonight."
"And what about tomorrow? And the days after that?"
"Your mother has moved beyond ordinary help now. I'll make all the arrangements myself, I promise you that. I'll do it this evening, and tomorrow I'll take her." She didn't understand. She shook her head, impatient.
"Take her where? What do you mean?"
"She can't stay here."
"You mean like Roddy?"
"I'm afraid it's the only way." She put a hand to her forehead, and her face convulsed. I thought she was crying, but she'd started to laugh. The laughter was mirthless. Terrible. She said,
"Dear God, how long till it's my turn?"
I took her hand. "Don't say things like that." She moved my fingers to the pulse in her wrist. She said,
"I mean it. Go on, tell me. You're the doctor, aren't you? How long do I have?"
I shook her off. "Well, not long at all, perhaps, if your mother stays here and something terrible happens. And that's exactly what I'm worried about. Look at the state of you now. How can you possibly cope, you and Betty? It's the only solution."
"The only solution? Another clinic?"
"Yes."
"We can't afford it."
"I'll help with that. I'll find a way. Once we're married..."
"We aren't married yet." "God!"
She put her hands together.
"Aren't you afraid?"
"Afraid of what?"
"Of the Ayres family taint."
"Caroline,
that's the sort of thing people will say, isn't it? I know there's already talk about Roddy."
"We're past the point, surely, of minding what people will say."
"Oh, it can't matter, of course, to someone like you."
She spoke almost savagely. I said in surprise, "What do you mean?" She turned away, confused.
"I just mean that what you're planning, what you want to do with my mother, she would hate it, if she were herself again, I mean. Don't you see? When we were children, whenever we were ill, she'd barely let us make a murmur. She said families like ours, they had a responsibility. They had to set an example. She said if we couldn't do that, if we couldn't be better and braver than ordinary people, then what was the point of us? The shame of your taking my brother was bad enough. If you try and take her too, I don't think she'll let you.
I said grimly, "Well, I'm sorry to say she won't have much choice. I'll bring Graham in again. If she acts with him in the way she's acted with me this afternoon, there'll be no question."
"She'd rather die."
"Well, it may kill her to leave her here. And on top of that, which worries me more, if I'm brutal about it, it might kill you. I won't put you through it. I hesitated over Roderick, and I've always regretted it. I won't make the same mistake again. If I could, I'd take her right now." And as I spoke, I gazed over at the windows. The white ground had kept the day light, but the sky was now a darkening zinc grey. Still, I thought seriously of taking her right there and then. I said, talking it through, "It could be done, I suppose. I could sedate her. We could manage her, you and I. The snow would hold us up, but we need only get her as far as Hatton in the first place." She said, appalled,
"The county asylum?"
"Just for tonight. Just while I make the arrangements. There are one or two private clinics I think will take her, but they'll want a day's notice at least. She needs to be kept under close observation now. That will complicate things." She was looking at me in horror, understanding at last how serious I was. She said,
"You're talking as if she were dangerous."
"I think she's a danger to herself."
"If you had let me take her away when I wanted to, weeks ago, none of this would have happened. Now you want to bundle her off to the madhouse like a lunatic on the street."
"I'm sorry, Caroline, but I know what she told me. I know what I saw. You can't expect me to leave her untreated, surely. You don't actually think I should abandon her to her delusions, purely for the sake of keeping intact some sort of class pride?" She had put her hands to her face again. Her fingers were steepled over her mouth and nose, the tips of them pressing into the red inner corners of her eyes. For a moment she gazed at me without speaking. I saw her draw in her breath, and as she released it, she seemed to come to some decision. She dropped her hands.
"No," she said, "I don't think that. But I won't let you take her to Hatton for everyone to see. She would never forgive me. You may take her tomorrow, privately. I'll be used to the idea then."
I hadn't seen her so certain and determined since the days before Jip's death. Slightly abashed, I said, "Very well, but in that case I'll stay here with you tonight."
"You needn't do that."
"I'll be easier in my mind. I'm due on the wards at 8, but for once I'll cancel. I'll say an emergency's come up. For God's sake, this is an emergency." I looked at my watch. "I can make my evening surgery and then come back, spend the night here." She shook her head.
"I'd rather you didn't."
"Your mother needs watching, Caroline, right through the night."
"I can watch her, can't I? Won't she be safest with me?"
I opened my mouth to reply, but her question had rung some sort of alarm bell in me, and I realized with a shock that I was thinking of that conversation I'd had with Seeley. I felt a touch of the sick suspicion that had risen in me then. The idea was impossible, grotesque. But other grotesque and impossible things had happened, there at Hundreds. And suppose Caroline was somehow to blame for them. Suppose, unconsciously, she had given birth to some violent, shadowy creature that was effectively haunting the house. Ought I to leave Mrs. Ayres unprotected there for even one more night? She was looking at me, waiting, confused by my hesitation. I saw a suspicion begin to creep into her clear, brown eyes. I shook the madness away. "All right," I said. "She can stay here with you. But don't leave her alone. That's all I ask. And you must telephone me at once if anything happens. Anything at all." She said she would. I put my arms around her for a second, then took her across the landing to her mother's room. Mrs. Ayres and Betty were sitting exactly as I'd left them in the thickening gloom. I tried a light switch, then remembered the silent generator, so took a flame from the fire to a couple of oil lamps and drew the curtains. The room at once grew cheerier. Caroline went to her mother's side.
"Dr. Faraday tells me you're not well, Mother," she said almost awkwardly.
She reached and tucked back a lock of her mother's greying hair.
"Are you unwell?"
Mrs. Ayres turned up her tired face.
"I suppose I must be," she said, "if doctor says I am. Well, I've come to keep you company. What shall we do? Shall I read to you?"
She caught my eye and gave me a nod. I left her taking Betty's place in the second armchair. Betty herself I took downstairs. I asked her, as I had asked Caroline, if she hadn't noticed any recent changes in Mrs. Ayres's behaviour, and if she hadn't seen any small injuries, scratches, or cuts. She shook her head, looking frightened. She said,
"Is Mrs. Ayres took bad again? Is it starting off again?"
"Nothing's starting again," I said. "I know what you're thinking, and I don't want you saying those things in this house. And you needn't be frit." I used the Warwickshire word almost unconsciously. "This is nothing like what happened before. I just need you to be a good girl for Mrs. Ayres and keep your head and do everything you're told. And Betty." She'd begun to move away. I touched her arm and added quietly, "Look after Miss Caroline too, won't you? I'm relying on you now. Call me if things don't seem quite right." She nodded, her lips pressed tight, some of her childishness fallen away. Outside, the snow had lost its dazzle with the darkening of the sky, and the day was even colder. Only the energetic trek back up the drive kept the warmth in my limbs, and once I was in my car, the chill began to tell on me, and I started to shake. The engine, thank God, turned at the first try, and the journey back to Lidcote was slow but uneventful. But I was still shaking as I let myself into my house, still shaking as I stood at the stove, hearing my evening patients gather on the other side of the wall. Only by holding my hands in a stream of what felt like nearly boiling water at the dispensary sink could I draw the cold from them at last and make them steady. Dealing with a string of routine winter ailments brought me back to myself. As soon as the surgery was over, I put through a telephone call to the hall, and hearing Caroline's clear, strong voice assuring me that all was well calmed me further. After that, I made two more calls. The first was to a woman I knew up at Rugby, a retired district nurse to whom I occasionally sent private patients as paying guests. She was more used to physical cases than to nervous ones, but she was a capable woman, and after listening to my guarded account of Mrs. Ayres's case, said she'd be very willing to take her for the day or two I would need to set up more appropriate care. I told her that, assuming the roads were clear, I would bring the lady to her tomorrow, and we made the appropriate arrangements. The second call I hesitated over, for I wanted simply to talk the thing through, and by rights I should have turned to Graham for that. But it was Seeley I rang in the end. He was the only man who knew all the details of the case, and it was a great relief to me now to tell him what had happened, mentioning no names on the open line but making everything clear enough, and hearing his usual genial tone grow very much graver as he took in what I was saying.
"That's bad news," he said, "and just as you suppose the whole thing blown over."
"And you don't," I asked, "think I'm acting too hastily?"
"Not at all. Haste is what's needed, by the sound of it."
"I didn't see much actual evidence that physical harm's been taking place."
"Did you really need to? The mental aspect is clearly worrying enough. Let's face it, no one wants to take this sort of step with people like that, least of all when there are, well, other involvements. But what's the alternative? Let the delusions run on, get an even stronger hold? Want me to come and back you up in the morning? I will, if you like."
"No, no," I said. "Graham will do it. I just wanted reassurance." "But, Seeley, listen." He'd been about to ring off. "There's one more thing. The last time we met, you remember what we talked about?" He was silent for a second, then said,
"You mean that gaff about Myers?"
"Was it gaff?
You don't think—"
"I have this feeling, Seeley, of danger. He was waiting, and when I didn't finish, he said firmly,
"You've done everything you can. Don't go troubling yourself now with crazy ideas. Remember what I said to you once before. What's being asked for here, essentially, is attention. It's as simple as that. Our patient may dig in her heels tomorrow when it comes to the crunch, but you'll be giving her what, in her heart, she craves. Get a good night's sleep now and don't brood on it."
Had our situations been reversed, I would have said exactly the same to him. But I went upstairs, not quite convinced, and had a drink and a cigarette. I ate my supper without appetite, then headed gloomily off to Leamington. I got through my hours at the hospital in a state of distraction, and when I drove home at just before midnight, I was still unhappy. As if the thought of Caroline and her mother were exerting some sort of magnetic pull over me, I inadvertently took the turning away from Lidcote and was a mile along the Hundreds Road before I saw what I had done. The weird pallor of the snowy landscape only added to my unease. I felt odd and conspicuous in my black car. For a moment, I actually considered carrying on, going out to the hall. Then I realized that to upset the house by arriving late like that would do no good to anyone, so I turned the car around, looking across the bleached fields as I did it, as if searching for a light, or some other impossible signal from hundreds that all was well. The telephone call came through next morning, just as I was sitting down to my breakfast after a broken night's sleep. There was nothing at all unusual in my being called at that sort of time. Patients often rang me then, wanting to be added to my round, but I was already in a keyed-up state, thinking of the difficult day ahead of me, and I sat tensely, straining to hear as my housekeeper answered. She came back through to me almost at once, looking puzzled and anxious.
"Excuse me, doctor," she said, "but it's someone wanting to speak to you. I can hardly make her out, but I think," she said, "she was calling from over at Hundreds."
I threw down my knife and fork and ran into the hall.
"Caroline," I said breathlessly, as I picked up the receiver. "Caroline, is it you?"
"Doctor?"
The line was bad because of the snow, but I could tell at once that the voice was not hers. It was high as a child's, and pinched, and weeping, and with panic.
"Oh, doctor, can you come? I'm to say, will you come? I'm to tell you—"
It was Betty, I realized at last, but her voice reached me as if from an impossible distance, broken up by puffs and squeals. I heard her say again,
"I'm to tell you. An accident."
"An accident?" My heart contracted. "Who's hurt? Is it Caroline? What's happened?"
"Oh, doctor, it's—"
"For God's sake," I cried. "I can hardly hear you. What's the matter?" Then, in a sudden burst of clarity,
"Oh, Dr. Faraday, she told me I wasn't to say."
And by that I knew it must be bad. "All right," I said. "I'll come. I'll come as quickly as I can." I went racing down the stairs to my dispensary to get my bag and to throw on my hat and overcoat. Mrs. Rush followed me anxiously down. She was used to me racing off to bad confinements and other emergencies, but she had never, I suppose, seen me quite as demented as this. The first of my surgery patients would be arriving soon. I called hastily to her that she must tell them to wait, to come back in the evening, to go elsewhere, do anything. She said,
"I will. But, doctor," holding out a cup, "you've eaten nothing. Drink your tea, at least."
So I stood for a second longer, gulping the hot tea down before bowling out of the house and into my car. It had snowed again in the night, not heavily, but enough to make the drive out to Hundreds a newly treacherous one. Naturally, I went too fast, and several times, despite the chains on my tires, felt the car slip and slide. Had I met another vehicle at those moments, I might have added another disaster to that already disastrous day, but as it was, the snow kept other drivers off the roads, and I saw almost no one. I looked at my watch as I drove, fretting over the racing minutes. I don't think I ever felt a journey as keenly as I felt that one. I seemed to sweat out the miles as I covered them, yard by yard. And then, at the gates of the park, I had to leave the car altogether and go slithering along the drive. In my haste, I'd put on my ordinary shoes, and within a minute my feet were soaked and freezing. Halfway along the drive I caught my ankle and turned it, badly, and had to go running on over the pain. Betty was at the door of the house as, limping and panting, I arrived at it, and I could see at once from her expression that things were quite as bad as I'd feared. When I joined her at the top of the steps, she put her hard little hands across her face and burst into tears. "Her helplessness was no use to me," I said impatiently.
"Where do you need me?"
She shook her head and couldn't answer. Beyond her, the house was silent. I peered up the staircase.
"Up there? Tell me!"
I caught her by the shoulders.
"Where's Caroline? Where's Mrs. Ayres?"
She gestured back into the body of the house. I went rapidly along the passage to the door of the little parlour, and, finding it ajar, pushed it open, my heart like a hammering fist in my throat. Caroline was sitting alone on the sofa. I saw her, and said in sick relief,
"Oh, Caroline, thank God! I thought—I don't know what I thought."
Then I saw how strangely she sat there. She wasn't pale so much as greyish. She didn't tremble. She seemed quite calm. She saw me in the doorway and lifted her head, as if mildly interested, no more, by the sight of me. I went across to her and took her hand and said, "What is it? What's happened? Where's your mother?" She said,
"Mother's upstairs."
"Upstairs alone?" I turned. She drew me back.
"It's too late," she said.
And then, bit by bit, the whole frightful story came out. She had sat with her mother the day before, it seems, just as I'd instructed. First she had read aloud to her, then, when Mrs. Ayres had begun to doze, she'd put the book aside and had Betty bring her her sewing. They had sat together like that, companionably, until 7 o'clock, when Mrs. Ayres went alone to the bathroom. Caroline didn't think she could very well accompany her there, and, in fact, her mother reappeared, having washed her hands and face, looking rather brighter than before. She even insisted on changing her clothes, putting on a smarter gown for dinner. They took the meal in the little parlour, as they usually did these days. Mrs. Ayres's appetite seemed good. Made wary and anxious by me, Caroline watched her very closely, but she seemed just her ordinary self. Just the ordinary self, in other words, that she had lately become. Quite quiet and tired, distracted, but not at all nervous. When the dinner was cleared away, the two women stayed in the little parlour, listening to a crackling music programme on the house's portable wireless. Betty brought them cocoa at 9 o'clock. They read, or sewed, until 10:30. Only then, Caroline said, did her mother grow restless. She went to one of the windows and put back the curtain and stood looking out at the snow-covered lawn. Once she tilted her head and said, "Do you hear that, Caroline?" Caroline, however, could hear nothing. Mrs. Ayres remained at the window until the draught drove her back to the fire. The fit of restlessness, apparently, had passed. She spoke of ordinary things, and her voice was steady. Again she seemed just herself. So calm did she appear, in fact, that at bedtime Caroline was almost embarrassed to insist on sitting with her in her room. She said it made her mother unhappy, too, to see her settling down with a blanket in the not very comfortable armchair, while she herself lay alone in the bed. But, "Dr. Faraday says I must," she told her mother, and her mother smiled.
"You might be married already."
"Hush, mother," said Caroline, self-conscious. "How silly you are."
She had given her mother a Veronal to take, and the drug acts swiftly. Mrs. Ayres was asleep within minutes. Caroline tiptoed over to her once to make sure she was warmly covered by her blankets, then she settled down again as best she could on the uncomfortable chair. She'd brought up a flask of tea with her and kept a dim lamp burning, and was content enough for the first couple of hours with her novel, but when her eyes began to smart she closed the book and smoked a cigarette and simply watched her mother sleep. And then, with nothing to check them, her thoughts became gloomy. She pictured all that was to happen the following day, all I planned to do, bringing in David Graham, taking her mother away. My anxiety and sense of urgency had impressed and frightened her before. Now she began to doubt me. Those old ideas rose up in her about the house, about there being something in it, or something that came to it, that wished her family harm. She looked through the shadows at her mother, lying slackly in her bed, and she said to herself, "Surely he's wrong. He has to be wrong. In the morning I'll tell him. I won't let him take her, not like that. It's too cruel. I'll take her myself. I'll go away with her right away. It's this house that's hurting her. I'll take her away, and she'll recover. I'll take Roddy, too." Her thoughts ran wildly like that until her head began to feel like an engine churning and hot. By now several hours had passed. She looked at her watch and found that it was almost 5, well past the dead point of the night, but still an hour or two from daybreak. She needed the lavatory, and she wanted to wash and cool her face. Her mother was apparently still deeply asleep, so she went around the landing, past the shut door of Betty's room, to the bathroom. Then, her flask of tea finished and her eyes still sore, she thought to calm herself down and keep herself awake by smoking another cigarette. The packet in her cardigan pocket was empty, but she knew there was another in the drawer of her bedside table, and since she could see very clearly across the well of the staircase into her mother's room, she went into her own room, sat on her bed, got a cigarette out and lit it. To make herself more comfortable, she just kicked off her shoes and raised her legs, so that she was sitting against her pillow with the ashtray in her lap. Her bedroom door was wide open, and the view across the landing was a very clear one. She kept impressing this fact on me when we talked about it later. By turning her head, she said, she could actually see, through the dimness, the footboard of her mother's bed. The house was so still she could even hear the steady, gentle push and draw of her mother's breaths. The next thing she knew, Betty was at her side, with the breakfast tray. There was a tray for Mrs. Ayres, too, sitting out on the landing. Betty wanted to know what she ought to do with it.
"What?"
asked Caroline thickly. She had woken from the deepest phase of sleep. unable to understand why she was on her bed rather than in it, fully dressed, very chilled, with a spilled ashtray in her lap. She propped herself up and rubbed her face.
"Take the tray into my mother, can't you? But if she's asleep, don't wake her. Leave it for her beside her bed."
"That's just it, miss," said Betty. "I think madam must still be asleep, for I've knocked and I've got no answer, and I can't take it.